Chapter 13, Gene Jackman. This is probably the most painful chapter of my life. When I went into Hap Morris's office there at the House of Representatives post office, met him, and he told me to go into the next room and give his secretary to fill out the application stuff with her. Little did I realize behind that door where she lay was a person who was going to have such a tremendous effect on my life. Anyway, I walk in and this beautiful blonde is sitting there. She gets out the form and starts going name, address, you know, and she gets down to marital status. And she said, married or single? I said, single, but I'm engaged. She says, like that. So that'll give you a hint what was coming up. Anyway, I got there in June of 1955, and I was up on Capitol Hill, and the gal I was engaged to, Joan Stevens, lived up in Bethesda, which is about 10, 12 miles away with her parents, and she came down daily to downtown D.C. to go to a business school. She'd already graduated with an English major from the University of Minnesota. She went to this business school, and after a short time, they hired her to teach something at night. So she's totally preoccupied with this business school. And I didn't have any car. Very few people have cars in D.C. The cabs were really cheap, and so there was excellent transportation. I would take a trolley downtown on Friday evenings early. She had a break in there about an hour between going to school and teaching school, and we would get together for a martini or something, maybe even something to eat. And that was about all we saw each other, that 1 hour on a Friday afternoon or evening. Near the end of December, early January, I was down there. I saw her. We had our usual cocktail and went our separate ways. I took the trolley back up to D.C. and got off on the corner there next to the House Office Building. And there was a bar right there, a restaurant bar right on the corner that I didn't frequent all that much, but that time I went in. And there was a couple there that she worked in what we called the cage at the post office, which is where they made sold stamps and stuff like that. Mary Bowman and her husband George. And sitting across from them was Gene. So naturally, there's a place for me to sit down right next to her. Well, long story short, I ended up at Gene's that night, and for several nights after that. And this is where it really got sticky, because she told me she was divorced, and it turns out she was separated. But at some point in this, I started sleeping out there every night. And I tell you how good looking she was. She was, she'd been queen of the D.C. Auto Show about 2 or 3 years prior, which is a big deal in D.C., bigger than Detroit. And she'd also had her, she'd been a model in New York City. She had her picture on I think it was a Pepsodent ad on the back of something like the Saturday Evening Post or Collier's. And anyway, a couple of times I'm over there and there's be a knock on the door, you know, might even be in bed and be a knock on the door, and here was, either our boss, old Hap Morris, or this congressman, Usher Burdick, which dropped by unannounced, you know, so I'd have to hot-foot it into a walk-in closet in the bedroom and hide in there till she got rid of him. Well, after about, about a month together, when I was in a rush to get out to get to the job, I had to catch a bus that took me down to a circle where I catch a trolley and get on down to the Capitol. And so I was running to catch this bus and slipped on a patch of ice and came right down on that knee that I smashed in North Dakota. And it was in such a way that That knee only went back 90 degrees after all that work we did on it, and I came down with a full weight on it, so I really tore it up good. I went into the eventually went into the medical office there in the Capitol, and a doctor looked at it and said, "Oh, this is beyond our capabilities." He gave me a business card for an orthopedic surgeon, and so I was scheduled. I went and saw the surgeon. I got scheduled for a knee operation. Well, about that time, Gene and I were sleeping one night, and oh, by the way, I did go and break the engagement with Joan Stevens and got the ring back and everything after about a month with Gene. Anyway, about 2 o'clock in the morning, kablam, down came the apartment door. And then rushed a bunch of guys with flashlights and cameras, and they they grabbed all the covers off the bed, and we were both buck naked. And they're taking all these pictures, and then they tore out of there. But they told the guy down at the bottom, this is a second floor apartment, so down at the bottom there on the landing, they told him he can come on up, but he never did. Turned out that was her husband that she told me she was divorced from, who is, I think, he's in the Navy band in. Stationed in Chicago. We also happened to be the son of the guy who owned the world's largest independent printing press in Manchester. So, is that Manchester, Vermont, is it, or New Hampshire? Anyway, we found out after a bit that his father had come over to see his grandson. Gene had a boy named Michael. He was about 5 years old, and pounded on her door, and there wasn't any answer, and this neighbor next door stuck her head out and said she thought Mr. and Mrs. Jackman had gone to work. Well, hell, he was Mr. Jackman. He knew his son wasn't in town, so, you know, the jig is up. So he hired these private eyes to break down the door and trying to get the custody of Michael for the husband. The husband, he never had guts enough to run up the stairs and grab Michael. Of course, I think by then Gene would have killed him if he came in the door, or what used to be the door. Anyway, we went to an attorney, laid it all out in front of him the next day, and he told her to get out of D.C. if possible. And she said, well, you got any place to go? And she said, well, this Congressman Burdick's a wife. She recently died on a honeymoon in North Dakota when a horse threw her. And so he still had the apartment in Arlington that she had, so she thought she could stay there, she called him. And that's what happened. In the meantime, my scheduled operation came up. I went out to Georgetown University Hospital and had the work done on that. And Gene was hiding out in Arlington, and but she didn't want to stay away from me, so she put on a brown wig, brunette wig, and came to the hospital a time or two. In the meantime, Mom showed up. She didn't want me to be all alone through all of this, so she showed up too. And between the two of them, at least we got a little booze in the room. I was in with two really interesting guys. One guy was in traction. For a bad back problem, but he had a long story about escaping from a Mexican chain gang. And the other guy was just sort of a hillbilly that had the greatest hillbilly jokes, you know. So the three of us in there had a good old time, and we'd get booze smuggled in there. Mom brought a six-pack of beer, I remember. Gene, I think, a small bottle of whiskey. But anyway, this is going on. I don't think Mom and Gene bumped into each other that whole time. But... next thing I know, I'm out of the hospital. I'm on Capitol Hill, and Gene's out in Arlington at that apartment. And she fixes a dinner for Congressman Burdick. He was 80-year-old, about 6'4", 300-pound, 80-year-old congressman. And she fixed him dinner, and then he'd go home to wherever he lived on Capitol Hill, near Capitol Hill. Then she'd give me a call, and I'd go on out there to that place, cab drive, cab fare was really cheap. I go out there and spend the night. Well, she took the attorney's advice. He told her to go to Reno or Las Vegas, so she picked Reno, and was had her airfare and everything all paid for by Usher, and she was going to leave the next day, and I was out there that night before, and it was about 11 o'clock at night, I think, and of course we're naked, and knock, knock, knock on the door. Gene says, "Who is it?" He says, "Usher, I come to get something." She says, "Oh my God." So I'm on crutches. I hobble into this walk-in closet. Gene throws my clothes in behind me, slams the door, and then opens the door for Usher. He comes in. He says, I got a satchel up here I need. And he opens the walk-in closet, and he does that old classic double take. He saw me, and his head turned out. Looked at her, looked back at me. He says, "Well, you dirty bastards, you sons of bitches." Here he gets that. I'm laying at the back of the walk-in closet, and all I'm wearing is a pair of crutches. He grabs that bag off the rack and bolts out of there. So then we had a little panic there. Gene forgot. He gave her a bunch of cash. She forgot where the hell she put it. So it came at the bottom of the sugar jar, I think. I had to dump the whole sugar jar out to find this $500. Anyway, early the next morning, we get out to D.C. airport. I'm hobbling along on a pair of crutches, holding one of her bags, and she's got another, and Michael. And her plane gets called, and off she goes. I'm like, jeez. Well, I hate to see her go, but I'm glad she went. You know, there goes a big problem out of my life. Well, a year went by. And I come home one night, and I had a sleeping in that rooming house with Greta and Alex. This place is right around the corner from all, where all this action is on that main street. And I go in the front door there, and Greta comes out of her bedroom. She says, "Racha, Racha," she says, "there was a beautiful girl looking for you here just a little while ago. She told me to tell you if you came home, she'd be at the Dew Drop Inn." So I said, "Oh, okay, Greta." So I go up to the Dew Drop Inn, was another half block up the street. And there's Gene with Michael, just back from Reno. Got her divorce, got her custody of the child, everything's great. She also has a pretty crummy apartment on East Capitol Street that Usher's paying for. So, well, we end up going over there, and I had another couple of close calls. One morning, he showed up unannounced, and I'm of course naked again, and I run into the bathroom with my clothes, and he slammed the door, and I jump in the tub, and there's a window there. These are old buildings, but the screen is nailed on from the inside. And I don't know where I found the strength, but I grabbed that screen and I yanked on it. There must have been a dozen nails in it, and I ripped it right out of there. I had on a pair of undershorts and the rest of my clothes. I opened the window and dropped out, and there was a damn basement steps, you know, outside the cellar steps. So I landed down on those, got banged up pretty good. And then East Capitol Street had a compact that every homeowner on the front, facing on the street, had to be white, but anybody behind it on the other side streets and behind all that was black. So it was all black except for the stripe down the middle of East Capitol Street. And I dropped right out there, and it's been a Sunday, I think, and there's a whole bunch of blacks all dressed up, just gone to church or going to church. I'm in my underwear, trying to put some clothes on, trying to get out of there, get around. I get enough clothes on, I start trotting down the street. I remember I threw up in some bushes on the way back to my apartment right on top of the hill, or the rooming house. Anyway, those were hairy times. Eventually, Gene was always after me to get married, but I just couldn't see marrying her. Breakfast for her was a half a tumbler of vodka. You know, it was just too much drinking. And so Usher asked her to marry him. She did. And there was a big picture of all the paper in the country. So this 80-year-old congressman with a 30-year-old wife. Oh, and he'd fallen somewhere, so he had a broken collarbone and his arm was in a sling. Anyway, he bought a house in Southeast D.C. for her, and she moved on out there. Then at some point, he took her to North Dakota, that ranch he had there, and dried her out and taught her how to drive a car. So when he came back to D.C., he bought her a car. Well, that was about the worst thing he could have done. You know, that put her on wheels. She didn't have to try to figure out how to get all the way from Southeast D.C. down to my apartment. By then, I was living in an apartment above the La Rosa Bar, which is one end of the far end of this real long, boozy street. And she'd just pop in there any old time she felt like it, you know. It wasn't too long that the word got out that that she was doing this, and Usher Burdick had a son who was a senator from North Dakota, Quentin Burdick, and Quentin sent his aide over to talk to my good friend Joe Warner to tell me to lay off. Well, I wasn't instigating it, but I didn't turn it down either. But when she popped up, he showed up. So next thing I know, I lose my patronage. If somebody pulls the strings, and I got no job on Capitol Hill. So that's when I started working part-time for Ted Mars at the bar. And then I also worked at the post office, but Hap Morse put me on what he called a double voucher. Somebody had determined, or some people had determined years ago, that a day's pay was $10. So, of course, that was ridiculous in 1956 or something. So Hap could put you on a double voucher, which would be $20 a day. Then, however, you could only work 15 days out of the month, because that 30 days worth of pay was used up in those 15 days. But still, that helped. You know, that was $300 I got working on my just regular job. Oh, by the way, when I got out of the hospital, I was in immobilized somewhat and with a leg operation. So they put me on, Hap put me on the primary, which is what you break the mail down as it originally comes into the post office, down to the floors. And then the job I used to have, those guys would come over and pick it up out of those boxes and take it and break it down even further to each individual office and deliver it. But I didn't have to deliver anymore. I just stood there at the primary. And eventually, I told Mom about my fate, about not having any job, and she had a good friend. My mom and dad had a good friend in Brainerd, who had a radio station, who was sort of sponsor or godfather to a congressman there from that area. And through those connections, I ended up getting patronage back, so I got my job back, in essence, just still doing what I was doing. But at some point, I lasted there 5 years. After about 4 years off and on, Gene Burdick, I finally decided that I needed to change my location, do things, get something different. And that's when I decided to go back, going to quit my job in D.C., go back to the University of Minnesota in the summer of 1960, and take a course in my major there and get that requirement out of the way so I could graduate. And so I went on a diet. I lost about 60 pounds. By then I weighed about 260 and got down to 200 and got a couple of suits and new clothes and saved some money. I worked for everybody. I did all the work I could over at the post office, working different shifts. saved up about $1,000, blew about $200 of it. The last couple of weeks I'm there just partying with all my old friends and took off, I had about five buddies, took me out to the airport, and Ted Mars had given me a case of miniatures, so I guess about 24 little miniature scotch bottles in a box, but I didn't get into that till I got on the airplane, but out there at the airport with those five guys I've been working with all those years, we were all feeling no pain by the time they loaded me, poured me on board that flight back to Minneapolis. I'll fast forward this story about Gene to, I was in Phoenix, I got a job, and Bruce and Marilyn were getting married, and I'm not sure the year was 62, perhaps, the spring of 62, but anyway, I flew there and went to the wedding, and then I had a couple of days extra to spare, and I hopped the train and went down to D.C., and looked up my old buddies there at the La Rosa or Ted's place, and I asked them if anybody had Gene's telephone number, and nobody did, so I got in a cab and the first night and rolled out to her place. And, I should back up on this. Just before I left Minneapolis for Arizona, in the papers it said that Usher Burdick had died, so I knew she was alone out there at that, or probably alone out that house on Southeast D.C., and went out there, and the doors open a bit, a little crack. I knock on it, and I hear, "Come in." I go in, and she's lying on the couch, and she's really in pretty bad shape. I talk to her, and I'm sure it's her, probably liver failure, you know, coming up. So she asked me if they help her up to the stairs to the bedroom and put her in bed, and I did, and I told her I'd call her the next night. I got her phone number, and I called her and talked to her briefly, and then I had to leave the next morning, so that was the end of it, essentially. I think I was back in Phoenix about 6 weeks when Penny called me. And she said, "Roger, did you read the paper today? Gene Burdick died." I said, "No." She said, "Well, I'll save it for you. It's on the second front page, I think." So I did. just said, "Gene Burdick, 30-something, died of a liver ailment." That was about all it said. So that was a sad end, a really steamy saga. Chapter 13, More D.C. When I worked in the post office there and ended up on the primary, I actually became pretty good at what I did. And at some point, they decided to have a contest between me and a guy named Jimmy Kravitz. Jimmy Kravitz was generally considered to be the best primary man there was. We worked in the envelopes. You know, we get in at times there'd be mass mailings from one thing or another to all the congressmen. So 435 congressmen. And we would take those mass mailings, were you know, all uniform size envelopes and everything else, and we would just split them in half and go at it. And we had a contest to see who's the best between me and Jimmy, and by golly, I won it. I had the fewest mistakes. I think we ended up about the same speed on what we did, but I think he had like three mistakes and I had two. So I was the king of that. And also, there was a contest to see who was the king of the Capitol Hill beer drinkers at one time. There was a guy named Scotty who worked over at the Library of Congress. and somehow a challenge got whipped up between Scotty and me. And we picked an afternoon and a time and sat in the back booth there at Mars's bar and proceeded to start drinking. And he was pounding them down real fast, which is not my style of drinking, so I had to stay with him. You know, I couldn't let him get out of reach. I think we got to about 22 bottles of beer apiece, and he says, "Butler, I quit, you win." and he hands me the $20 bill that we had bet, and I got up and waddled out of there. Went up to my apartment above the La Rosa bar and flopped on the bed and slept for a couple hours. I got up and came back down and went into the La Rosa to get an eye-opener, and there's Scotty sitting with another guy, still drinking. He takes one look at me and says, "Hey, Butler, give me my $20 back." I said, "Hell no, you quit." And I kept it. Working on that post office, that was a place just full of characters. Cause they came from all over the country. We had Polish, Polish guy from Pennsylvania and a bunch of Southerners. And one guy from West Virginia, name was Morgan Poe. And I had a kind of a sharp tongue for some guys that wouldn't work too good. You know, we worked very fast and everything. And old Morgan over there, he'd always say, "Roger, you say the cutting is thins." And I was going to get a laugh out of that. One of the guys I didn't work with at Dan was, his name was John Flanges from Nevada. And John was a little older than most of us in there, but they put him on the package primary, which was a pretty easy job. And he flopped at that. I mean, the guy was in slow motion. So I kept calling him Flangeass instead of Flangus. "Hey, Flangeass." He'd yell back, "It's Flangus." I said, "Nah, it's Flangeass." And, you know, I'll be son of a gun that he was a law student, which we had several guys who were law students, you know, working their butts off to go to law school. And at some point, I found out that, he's picked up his pace. He started working and came in our good graces and found out that he'd been a paratrooper that had jumped into Sicily during World War II. So I was lucky old John Flangus didn't get on me. John was one of the guys that poured me on the airplane that day I left D.C. Other guys around there was a guy named Johnny, doggone, I can't remember his last name, from Tennessee, a really nice kid. He loved to talk about Jack Daniel's liquor. He was another law student. And one time he and I got together. He had a bottle of Jack Daniel's, and we proceeded to put a pretty good dent in that. And he had a guitar with him. So we went up the flight of stairs to the front of the house office building. There was a cop station back in there a ways. And John and I proceeded to serenade him with "Way Down in Columbus, Georgia, Wanna Go Back to Tennessee," and other such songs like that. And we got pretty good reception from the cop, I think. He was happy I broke up the boredom. And a couple years later, John was in the Navy, and the Naval Intelligence came by to ask me if, or maybe it was the FBI, but that John wanted to apply for a job at the Naval Intelligence, and what did I think of him? I gave him a rosy glow. He was really a good kid. John worked on what they call the Capitol case, which they delivered mail over to the Capitol. And I had a sub for him off and on because of his law school job. So John took me over there and showed me how to handle the Capitol case. When I worked the primary, the next step was these guys would take the mail from where I was and break it down into the case. And when they got enough at a certain time, they had to deliver the mail to the various rooms and stuff or floors and stuff. And so I wouldn't be working at that point, so I could just go along with John and learn the route. And that was the damnedest route. I call it the house of many doors when you get over to the house side of the Capitol. They just had they had no names on them or numbers on them. You wouldn't know what it was. But John knew. And at one point, you down there, there's statues. You know, every state can have two statues of some famous sons, and one sets up in Statuary Hall in the rotunda, and the other just sat in the basement down there. We go by it, and at one point we had these big steel trucks. We'd want to go down around a corner and come back and catch it a little further down the hallway. So we just shove that old metal truck real hard and sail it down that hallway. That's where all those statues were, and I could hear it go kablang, kablang, and knocking into the, every once in a while, you think you're chipping some of the marble off of them. And one time I was over there, had a little, also a little two-wheeler mail thing you could take out of your truck and take it upstairs and around the speakers of the house offices and stuff. I was getting on this kind of crowded elevator with it, and I backed up as best I could, and one final figure was getting on. He stepped on my feet. So he says, "Oh, excuse me," and I said, "That's okay, Mr. Martin." He was the minority speaker, Joe Martin, a really nice guy. You know, I had a party one time. I had a roommate named Harvey, and for a while above La Rosa, and Harvey and I threw a party one time for, I guess it must have been about eight of us in there. A lot of Frank Sinatra music going on and stuff. And all of a sudden the door flew open. There's three guys walk in. And, you know, we were two flights up off the street, so it wasn't like you could just stroll in there. Anyway, I tried to usher them out of there. I tried to scoop them up and get them out of there. And next thing I know, they charged me. I'm flat on my back. One of them's pinning me down. We're both two pinning me down, and another one kicked me right in the eye. So eventually the cops came and talked to everybody, and then they wanted to know if I wanted to go to the hospital. So I declined that, but I had a real shiner. The next morning I went to work, and my buddy Dean Matteo spotted me. He knew I was going to have that. He's had that party. He says, "Well, how was your party?" I told him, "Hey, it was a smashing success." He that tore him up. He got a big kick out of that. Eventually, that I did get eyesight back in that eye. You know, you mentioned Doc Steinberg was the bookie, and they caught up with him at one time. He was the pharmacist. Well, actually, he went to prison. I remember now. He went to prison, I think, for about a year. When he got out of prison, he went back to the pharmacy. He lost his license, so I don't know what he was doing in the pharmacy, but he was still making book. You can still make horse bets with old Doc. And one time, Gene and Dick Jones and I went to the Preakness, and that's the only one of the Triple Crowns I've ever been up in Baltimore. Really nice club car all the way up there, and you know, about an hour ride up there, and we get out to the Preakness. We had we're not too far from the finish line, and in a good area over there. And there was a heavy favorite, was a horse named Tim Tam, but there was a California horse named Silky Sullivan, who had some sort of lung condition or esophagus condition, and He had a breathing problem, so it took him a while to run before he really got going. But then he was running so well in California that and won so many races by coming from behind that his owner was banned from watching him by his doctor because he was just going to give him a heart attack. He made him walk out of the stadium and the stands and walk and wait till the race was over and come back in and see if Silky had won it. Well, that caught my fancy. So what money I had left after a few races there, I put all down on Silky Sullivan, and they're off, you know. And it's, here they come roaring by. I was near the first turn, and they're pounding by with all these horses, and clippity-clop, 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 way behind is Silky Sullivan. They go around the next bend, and all turn around there, and then back behind them, not quite so far back, though, it's clippity-clop, old Silky, clippity-clop. They get around the far turn. It's pretty much the same, but he's starting to catch up a little, and they come tearing down the final stretch. Here comes Tim Tam in the lead, and about four horses back in there, there's old Silky Sullivan. He never did get out there. He never did get there. So I lost everything. Tim Tam won. There was a guy named Jack Bourbon. I love that name. Real good-looking guy, and Jack worked for some congressman up there. It's an old Maryland name, Bourbon, Baltimore. He's from Baltimore originally. And Jack said he's going to go to Florida looking for work. Did I want to go along one time? for a month. I said, yeah, we had a month's vacation, you know, so why not? So we went down there, and we went on the wagon. While we were down there, we were on the beach for about a week, and then we got an apartment in Miami, and then we stayed on the wagon till about a week left to go. I fell off before he did. I ended up at this really big bar, quite a few Navy personnel around. Behind the front bar was a pedestal with a piano player up on it, and then behind him was the dance hall and the booths back in there, so it was pretty large. And I'm sitting there, and four or five swabbies come in, and with a girl trailing behind them, a nice-looking girl, and they ignored her. So they're standing around talking, and she's just standing there. So I said, well, would you like to dance? She says, yeah. So I went out on the dance floor, and I came back, and those guys were waiting for me when I got back. So I got into it real quick. I got in some pretty good licks, but I remember I had a big old mouthful of tooth marks on one wrist, but there was a lieutenant that's waded into that to break it up, and shortly after that, the shore patrol came tearing. They must have been out in the parking lot, practically, came in there and broke it all up. So I went back to my drink, and before I got into that fight, I had taken my glasses off and just wrapped the frame around my drink, and I went back over there. Shortly, the piano player took a break, great big guy, came down, he sat next to me, and he says, I got to buy you a drink. He says, that's the funniest thing he'd ever seen. He said, a guy will wrap his glasses around a drink before he starts swinging. You know, I never was much of a fighter, but I didn't have much choice in that situation. Those guys jumped me, and I had to defend myself. Mom and Dad called me one year, and they're going to a big broadcaster convention in Chicago, and did I want to meet up with them? Well, yeah, it sounded like a good weekend, but 3 days there, I guess, or two or three nights. So they sent me a ticket, and I flew into Chicago and met up with them in one of those big hotels downtown in the Loop, and we really had a good time. But it was just one party room after another, nothing but food, good food, and good booze. And eventually I had to fly back to D.C., and I got on this airplane. I think it wasn't a jet, it was a prop. And took off out of Chicago, and had to make a few stops. So Pittsburgh, I remember, was one of them. And we hit the worst weather that you can imagine. This plane bounced around in the air, so it didn't even have the luggage bins you think of now, you know, the carry-on bins above. It just had a shelf with a retaining rope on it, and luggage was put up in there, you know, carry-on luggage. And I remember we bounced around so bad that a piece of luggage flew off of that shelf and split a bald-headed guy's head right open, blood flowing all over the place. And you just can't imagine how violent this whole flight was. Landing in Pittsburgh was like on a small field on the top of a mountain, it seemed like. And anyway, by the time we got to a national airport in D.C. and I got off that airplane, I got down on the tarmac and kissed it. I didn't fly again for another 3 years at least. I didn't want to fly then. That's the year they poured me on the airplane to get back to Minneapolis. I was loaded then, so I'd hardly remember that flight. You know, what an awful deal. At D.C., they have it's what's called Potomac fever. You know, once you're there, you never want to leave. Well, they even have a columnist there that had it. Label on the column was Potomac fever. It really is a tough place to leave. You know, there was, for one reason, there's something like 8 or 10 women to every man. And even though maybe half of them were black, that still left a lot of women around. And And then the partying is just constant partying going on, so nonstop. So it's a hard place to leave, and pretty easy work. I was going to go to work for or try to get a job with the Navy personnel, and went out and had an interview at one of the Navy bases, and got into this office. There's about four or five guys interviewing me, and one of them was as nasty as could be. And, you know, he says, what do you want to work here for? This is an awful job, blah, blah. And he goes on. He just completely tore down the whole job and everything else. And they told me at the end of the interview that if I got my college degree, they would give me a job. And when I went out to get on, and there was a base bus to get me to the gate before I could get another bus, one of the head interviewer got along with me, and he said, really got to apologize to that first guy. I says, he just really hates his job. I said, yeah, you tell me. Yeah, I could see that. So that kind of killed any interest in working for Navy personnel. I think I mentioned that we used to play the numbers there. Now they got, of course, a lottery everywhere. You can play it legally. But then the numbers game was run by the mob. But I play I was coming out of the house office building, going across the side street there, and there's my good friend Joe Warner, who was, well, he worked for United Press News Photos, and he went into work, I think, about 10 in the morning and got off around 6 or 7 at night. And I usually stop, you know, I play a number with Joe, I give him a buck or a half a buck or something. And it was close to my birthday, so it must have been in January. And I walk right by a car. I'm trying to think of a number. And I walk by a license plate that says RB723. Says, well, what the hell? That's a good tip. So I say, Joe, here, put a buck on 723, those three numbers. And nothing happened that day. And the next day I said, well, do it again. I gave him another buck. That night I'm sitting in Mars Bar, and Joe came in around 7 o'clock or so, and he says, hey, you hit it. And he hands me $700. So I tried to give him half of it, and he says, no, no. He says, I had a buck on it too. So he had $700. The odds are 1,000 to 1. Muscled the bookie down at the UPI building. He paid off 700 to 1. And most every other bookie would pay 600 to 1. The rest they called, you know, carrying charges. But boy, we were fat cats there for a while. Well, just a few more things here to wrap up D.C. My friend Jack Bourbon, the last time I saw him, he had joined the D.C. Metropolitan Police Force. When he was down in, when we were down together in Miami, the best jobs he could find for us was working on the in the oil fields in Venezuela, and that didn't sound very good to either one of us. So we went back after 5 weeks in Florida, we went back to D.C., Jack joined the cops. There was one time I was gone for a couple of days and came back to my apartment. And no, I think it was with that trip with Joe up to Canada, and came back in there. He stayed on in, for a few days in Providence, and I came all the way back down to D.C., went into our apartment, and there was thousands of roaches crawling everywhere. You know, we were positioned over a restaurant, and boy, oh boy. So I dashed on down to the local hardware store and bought, I think, two or three cans of roach spray, you know, and I went up there, and I had to pull a shirt up over my head to keep them from dropping down my the neck and everything. Anyway, I sprayed all over that place. I went down to the nearest bar and waited about an hour and went back. There were still a few moving, but I got most of them. One other time, coming back from a short trip, I came around the corner in a cab, and there's a couch sitting on the street. I said, boy, that sure looks a lot like our couch. Hell, it is our couch. And it had a big old burn hole on one arm, or down at one end. So when I got upstairs, there was my roommate there. He said, yeah, I fell asleep, Joe O'Connell. I fell asleep with a cigarette, he says. and had to call the fire department. So there went that couch. I don't remember what we ever did to replace it. Not much, I guess. after Gene went to Reno, well, you know, I was girlfriendless, and Joe Warner, my good buddy, was dating a waitress. Her name was Myrtle, and Myrtle had a pretty big apartment out in Southeast D.C. And Joe said, "Let's go down to Myrtle's one day. He's got some people there, so some girls there." So I go down there, and there's two or three young ladies around. It turns out Myrtle was an abortion layover. This colored Dr. Brown, he was already out on probation for illegal abortions, but I guess he still had to pay his attorney and everything, so he's still aborting people. He didn't do it surgically. He did it with some sort of liquid he shot up in there, and in a day or two they'd abort. As a consequence, I met a real nice North Carolina girl named Wilma there, and Wilma and I went together probably for about another year. When Gene got back to town, I dumped Wilma and went back to Gene. You know, I always called D.C. a maggot magnet. You know, it seemed like every kind of person in the world comes there. A lot of them bad, but a lot of really, really great personalities. It was a heck of a time.